welcome to episode 22, or if you prefer, season 2, episode 1 of Eye on Horror. Hey, I'm your host, James J. Edwards, and with me for another season is Jacob Davidson. How you doing, Jacob?
I'll be getting into it, but a little tired.
He's been hitting all of the triple features and midnight screenings this weekend. So, we got to bear with him. But a little more bright-eyed and bushy-tailed is your other host, John Correa. How you doing, John?
Dude, great. I just had an energy drink, so I'm fucking ready to start the season off right.
Yes.
You guys ready? Like, season 2, we beat Firefly, guys. We passed Firefly.
We beat Freaky Links.
Oh,
I know. Freaky what?
Oh, we also beat Tremors the series.
Both.
Yeah,
right?
both the pilot and the original one on Sci-Fi with Michael Gross.
Yeah.
So we double beat Tremors the series.
Cool. Well, let's dive right into it. What have you guys been doing this week? I want you guys to go first, because what I want to hear from is Eric Andre's Fire Festival 2. It's the least horror thing we're probably going to talk about today, but I got to hear how that went.
I mean, we have to talk about it.
Yes, we do.
It was pretty awesome, because one of the main things about that show is they didn't announce any of the performers, like we said last time, so it was all going in blind, and it turned into probably one of the best music and comedy mashup shows I've been to. Unfortunately, I had to leave a bit early, so I missed Hannibal Buress, but it was awesome. And leading up to it, he kept posting on Instagram, like, the guy who was going to suck dick for Avia and Water, he took a picture with him and posted on Instagram before the show. He's like, do you think we're fucking around here? Do you think we're fucking joking?
Do you think this is a game?
Yeah.
It loses credibility that they let you leave early, because a real fire festival would have had you isolated until the end of the damn thing.
Yeah, we would have been inside a FEMA tent.
I mean,
on an island.
To put it nicely, I think they kind of had to let me leave early for the liquor license purposes.
you were bankrupting them.
But no, it was awesome. Tiffany Haddish performed, and she was awesome to see live.
Oh, and Reggie Watts, he did a great set.
Reggie Watts' set was one of the greatest things I've witnessed, but there were FEMA tents. Jacob, I think you got some cheese sandwiches?
They had a big pile of cheese sandwiches and styrofoam plates.
I saw on Facebook the cheese sandwiches. That's amazing.
Yeah.
they couldn't have done it without those, though. I mean,
And I ate one.
Was the Avion Water guy there? Did you guys
see
him?
He was.
He was. Nice.
Yeah, no, he came out. He came out on the stage, and it was pretty funny. They just brought him out. He was like, hey, guys, and like said a few things. By that point, I was already gone. I was running around shirtless wearing a kimono, so, you know.
Yeah, and he tracked me down and dragged me with him into the crowd, along with some strangers who it just kind of went because Jonathan was so charismatic in his kimono.
I don't know about charismatic. I think more just loud.
They probably thought you were part of the show. You're like, is this going to be on the next season?
For a moment, and then everyone just realized, oh, that's the guy who had too much.
Is this a new character? Yeah, you did. You quote left early, but really you got thrown out? Is that what you're saying?
No, I did not get thrown out. I left on my own accord because I was like, this is bad.
Well, it was funny. We left around the same time because we got hungry, and they had a pizza bagel truck outside. So we're like, shit, let's get pizza bagels.
Yeah, yeasty boys.
Yes.
I finally had some yeasty boys, and it was awesome.
Oh, my God, yes.
So good.
Speaking of the Eric Andre show, though, he did make an official announcement that the fifth season was coming, and it was going to be the final season.
Let's move on to, I just wanted to hear about that for my own benefit, and hopefully the listeners were as amused as I was. Let's move on to horror stuff. What have you guys been doing this week?
Well, I saw, it's horror adjacent, Missing Link, the new Lake
film. I did too.
There's
it's
a Bigfoot
big
in it. There's a Sasquatch. That's
Loch Ness
horror.
Monster.
Yeah, it was delightful. You know, I have to say it was probably one of the more straightforward Leica films. It wasn't as like, I don't want to say it was bad, but it was. I think it's one of the weakest of the Leica films out of the five that they've produced so far. But
it was no Paranorman, is what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. When you stack it against Paranorman, Box Trolls, Kubo Korlan.
What else been going on this week?
I went to, there's this pop-up in LA. They do these pop-ups where people go and they set up stuff so social media people can take pictures with it. There'll be like a bunch of noodles and they'll be in the noodles and they'll do their Instagram influencer Snapchat bullshit. And I don't go to those, but they did one in LA called I Like Scary Movies, which was a lot of fun, not gonna lie. It was all Warner Brother movies, so there was stations for The Shining, Nightmare on Elm Street, It, Lost Boys, Beetlejuice, and it was all not only photo ops, it was cool. They did like cool artistic things with it. Like for The Shining, they had the elevator, but instead of blood, it was all hotel keys that were red that said 237. You know, they had the Tower of Fear, where the kids were floating around for it and stuff. And it was cool. It was all interactive art. But you were mainly there to take pictures for social media, you know, because people need to add more pictures to their Friendster accounts, you know?
Friendster. Is that even still a thing?
I don't know. I tried looking up my MySpace.
I was going to say, that was before MySpace.
Yeah. Apparently it got deleted in that big whoops.
Your MySpace did? Oh, yeah. I haven't even checked mine, but I'll bet mine's gone.
All
too.
That MySpace music, long gone.
That is actually end of an era.
I had all my music that was on MySpace backed up to other places, so none of that, you know, all of my band's legacies are still intact in other places.
That's awesome.
What about you, Jacob? What have you been doing?
Oh, man. I've had a full weekend. I was at the midnight screening of Mandy over at the New Art. They had Joe Lynch, the director, again, moderate a quick discussion intro with one of the producers, John C. Waller. Like something you talked about that I'd never heard before was that Nicolas Cage had a broken ankle when he made the movie. He did a stunt from like another movie, and like when he went onto Mandy, like he had a broken ankle, which is why, you know, he goes all Jason Voorhees at the end, because Jason doesn't run, he paces, so they needed him, you know, to be able to do all this action at a slow pace.
Do you guys remember seeing our friend Patty Pauly, who used to write for iHorror? She saw Nicolas Cage, and she lives in Las Vegas, and I guess he does too, somewhere around there. And she saw him looking real confused in the tampon aisle, and he's in a suit. And she took a picture, and it went kind of viral. So, listeners,
I remember that.
It went super viral.
Yeah, listeners may have actually seen the picture, but that was our buddy Patty that took that picture, and it pretty much took. It was a pretty amazing picture.
It was awesome because, like, it really did take off. Like, I was seeing it on other things, on, like, meme sites and stuff, and it was just...
And people were putting the confused Travolta from Pulp Fiction in front of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, so saw Mandy at Midnight again, and I swear that movie just gets better and better every time I see it in a crowd like that. And also, I won this Cheddar Goblin hat that I'm wearing right now. It's a little beanie with, like, Cheddar Goblin enjoying some macaroni and cheese on it. Yeah, and, oh, man, so yesterday was 4/20.
Yeah, we're recording this on Easter Sunday. That's how devoted we are to season 2.
Yeah.
Yeah. We gave up our rituals. I'm supposed to be watching sleazy movies right now as part of my Easter ritual.
And I'm supposed to be poking my cat in the paw to get a glucose check on him. But we're here. Okay. What'd you do last night, Jake?
Okay. So last night, the Egyptian Theater did a triple feature of, like, dimension hopping type movies, like stuff with I guess people going on trips. So it was Army of Darkness, Waxwork.
I see what they did there.
and The Beyond. And it was so great. They were all on 35mm. Like, we saw the only 35mm print of Waxwork in existence. And they all look great. It was a fun time. And when I was a resident, that's why I'm tired, because it was a long one. But the best part was I won this giant embossed poster of the event from a contest. Like, we had to tell our worst getting high stories, and there were two winners, and I was one of them.
Do you ever go anywhere where you don't win something?
No.
Yeah, seriously.
I'm pretty sure that you win something. I don't think you've ever gone to Dead Right Trivia without winning something. And here you are in your Cheddar Goblin hat with your poster from this weekend.
Yeah.
Lucky or knowledgeable.
Like a great man once said, I'm by winning. I can't stop winning.
Oof. Tiger blood here.
Yeah, tiger blood. But yeah, so it was a fun time last night, and the only downside was, since I had that big poster. Oh, and also I got a copy of Waxwork and Waxwork 2 on Blu-ray out of it.
Nice.
And I feel Waxwork 2 is very underrated, if only for the line, "You're in God's Nintendo machine."
That's beautiful.
Yeah. But yeah, so like I took the bus to the theater, so I had to call a Lyft to get back. But it was cool because like the dude who picked me up is like super into Army of Darkness. So we just ended up talking about Army of Darkness at like 2 a.m. While he was driving me back home.
I saw a couple of cool things. First of all, I saw Pet Sematary.
Oh, yeah. I saw that
and
too.
And I freaking loved it.
Same,
right? It's been pretty polarizing. A lot of people are thinking that it's terrible. And for me, I mean, it's a different adaptation, so I don't really think it's a remake of the original, because they change enough, and if you've seen it, you know exactly what they changed.
Yep.
But it mm-hmm. is, I think it's more like the original Evil Dead compared to the remake of the Evil Dead, because
yeah.
it's more brutal. I think it's better made. The acting is a huge upgrade, so you really get a sense of the grief, because I think Jason Clark and Amy Simetz can act circles around... was it Dale Midriff or what? And I don't even remember. Denise Crosby, I think, was the other woman. But anyway, I mean, John Lithgow is a good Judd.
I loved him as Judd.
Fred Gwynn was kind of a cartoon. And I remember, I think I was hearing it on Shockwaves. They were talking to the directors, and they had said that Lithgow, in the first table reading of the script, he did it with that heavy New England accent like Fred Gwynn. And then when they went to shoot, he didn't. You know, and his reasoning was, I just wanted to prove to you that I could do that, and now I'm going to do it my way.
Fucking John Lithgow.
Oh, yeah, and it's a more grounded interpretation of the character, which, I mean, there's nothing wrong with Fred Gwynn. Fred Gwynn's probably the most memorable thing about that, you know, that's about our wire, you know, but it's so...
Sometimes dead is better.
But it's so Pepperidge Farm remembers, you know, it's so... But, you know, Lithgow is so much more subtle, and he also puts in the justification for why... Because one thing that was missing from the original was, why the hell did Judd show him what's past the bramble anyway? Well...
Yeah.
Lithgow's Judd actually explains that. So, I don't know. I loved it. A lot of people, it's getting a lot of hate, and I don't understand it, because it's not like it is erasing all of the tapes and DVDs of the old movie. You know, you can like them both, but yeah, I loved it. It was awesome.
And ultimately, no one can beat Clancy Brown and Pet Sematary 2, because that's just unmatched. But honestly, I would be super okay if these filmmakers went on to redo Pet Sematary 2, like do their interpretation of that as well.
Oh,
that
my
would
God.
Dude, Pet Sematary 2 is overlooked, and it's a crime. It's not a great movie, but God damn it, is it fun.
Oh, yeah. No, I've really been meaning to rewatch that, because it was on, like, Netflix or something for a long time, but now they, like, took it off, so, like, I'm going to have to probably, like, buy it or rent it.
Well, you can usually get it on Vudu when they have one of their... In fact, I think they might be having one now, one of their Stephen King sales. You can usually get it for, like, $4.99.
They have a big Stephen King sale right now.
That's the thing. Like, they used to play Pet Sematary and Pet Sematary 2 on TV, like, the Sci-Fi Channel and stuff, like, a lot.
Yeah,
so,
all
like,
the time.
So, yeah. Although I feel like they played Pet Sematary 2 more on TV, though, because like I remember that one a lot better. But yeah, no, Clancy Brown steals the whole movie. So I honestly don't know if they did like a kind of remake of Pet Sematary 2, who they could get to replicate that kind of evil hamminess.
Yeah, just bring back Clancy Brown. He's still kicking it. He's still doing shit.
Yeah, just
come on.
Clancy Brown. He's just older now.
We love you, Clancy.
Yeah.
Also, I saw, and this one's kind of horror adjacent, it's the new Claire Denis movie. She's the director who made Chocolat back in the day.
And Trouble Every Day.
Yeah, yes. And her new movie's called High Life, and it's her English language debut.
Oh.
Robert Pattinson, the setup is, it starts with Robert Pattinson on this spaceship with an infant, you know, baby, and... You know, most of it's told through flashbacks and flash forwards, actually. It jumps around time-wise a lot. But he's the last survivor of this ship of death row inmates that are being sent to a black hole, basically.
Damn.
And it's It's like they gave him a choice. They said, look, you can either be on death row and get executed, or you can go on this essentially a suicide mission. So, you know, this ship is full of these, you know, convicts. And, you know, of course, one of the convicts who becomes kind of the de facto leader, she's played by Juliette Binoche. She's a doctor. So she starts doing weird fertility experiments with them, you know, which, you know, little spoiler alert, that's why he ends up with a baby, you know, as his last survivor. But it's kind of a, not really disturbing, but it's kind of an unsettling movie. It's kind of like Silent Running meets Event Horizon. Yeah,
kind of. Oh, he sold me on that.
It's definitely worth seeing. And Robert Pattinson takes the damn movie on his shoulders and carries it. I mean, he's that dude. Every movie he's done since the Twilight movies have ended, I mean, he just keeps raising his game. That guy is just wanting to prove to people. Same with Kristen Stewart, actually. They just want to prove to people that they're more than just the pretty faces that carry the Twilight franchise, because they're both making great movies. But I also saw The Curse of La Llorona.
Wait, real quick. Did anybody watch Hellboy?
No.
No, I didn't.
That's okay.
I thought about it, but I couldn't get excited for it.
Here's the thing. I don't think it's a good Hellboy movie. It's a fun monster movie at times, but it's very meh.
So you did see it?
I did see it. Okay. I have AMC Pass, so it was no skin off my chin. But it was definitely one of those Like, Lindsay, my fiance asked me, what was your favorite part of the movie? And I was like,
was there a part?
I couldn't remember a part, like most of the movie. Like, I just left the theater. I was like, Lobster Johnson, I guess? But he's only in it for like 2 seconds.
It's never a good sign. And this actually happened with La Llorona as well. It's never a good sign when they don't screen a movie for press. And they didn't with Hellboy. Hellboy, I mean, for me, it's hard to get excited about it because with no GDT and no Ron Perlman, it doesn't feel like Hellboy to me. And I'm sure I'll watch it at some point, but I'll probably feel the same way that I did about, you know, like the RoboCop remake. You know, it's not going to hold a candle.
It's not as bad as everyone says it is. If they had if they had been like, oh, it's Hellboy during his teenage years, a lot of it would have made sense. Like if they didn't do this one bit in the movie, it could almost play off as a prequel to the Guillermo del Toro movies, because the whole movie Hellboy's just getting his ass handed to him and whining and fighting with the professor the entire time like a teenager would, which I actually I didn't hate. You know, I was like, oh, it's a different take on him. It's like he's a younger Hellboy just still trying to get his shit together. But then also, like, the guy who played him.
David Harbour.
Yeah. I don't know if it was him or the script, but a lot of his acting was him shouting a lot.
Okay.
So, but again, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, hey, if you're bored on a day and it comes up on HBO, it's not a bad way to kill it.
That's probably when I'll catch it. It'll be on Amazon Prime or, you know. It'll hit Netflix, and that's when I'll catch it.
Yeah.
Mm.
But, you know, back to Curse of La Llorona. It is, you know what? I feel the same way about it as I feel about The Nun. It is a pretty well-made movie. And the director, he directed the shit out of it. It is, I mean, he made a movie. But the script, you can't polish a turd. And the script is really, really bad. So it's a pretty meh movie. But I guess the director, I think his name is Michael Chavez. And if I'm wrong on that, someone will correct me. He is doing The Conjuring 3. So this gives me not so much hope, because I always have hope for the Conjuring movies, but I think that the Conjuring 3 is in good hands, because this guy knows how to make a movie, and hopefully he'll have a better script with Conjuring 3, because it's just a real, you know, it's exactly what you think. If you know the legend, it's exactly the movie you think it is, and it's supposedly part of the Conjuring universe, but I feel like the studio knew they had a crap movie. And they're like, you know what? We need a couple reshoots to kind of, strenuously tie that. You know, it's reaching. The ties to the Conjuring universe are very, very reaching with this. And it's I feel like they just, that's how they're trying to get butts in the seats. They're like, oh, it's in the Conjuring universe. You have to come see it. Like, yeah, okay, I guess for completists. But there's a reason why we left this one for last, because we're going to move on to our subgenre, which has to do with that. So take it away, Jacob.
All right. Well, with the release of La Llorona and just seeing how big these movies are, I figured it'd be a good time to talk about the Conjuring series of movies. You know, the movies that take place within the kind of Conjuring verse that's been established since the first movie and through the collective works of James Wan and other horror filmmakers.
Yeah. You can't deny the massive impact that those films have had on the horror landscape over the last few years. I mean, it's kind of like what Universal's trying to do with their classic monsters. They already have with the Conjuring universe, being able to introduce these small characters in the main films and then spin them off into their own series. I mean, there's what, three Annabella films at this point?
Yeah, the third one is coming out this summer, and actually I saw a trailer for it with La Llorona, and it looks really good.
Annabelle Comes Home.
Yeah, Annabelle Comes Home looks really good. Now, granted, this is a trailer. You can make a lot look good in a trailer, but Annabelle Creation I really liked. I didn't mind Annabelle. You know, it wasn't great. I think it suffered from performances more than anything else. I think that they had a cast that you just don't care about. But I still think it's a better movie than The Nun.
Now, I just want to clarify for my own beliefs and purposes and whatnot, that we're discussing the Conjuring movies that are based on Ed and Lorraine's lives, and they do star those as characters. I have a lot of strong opinions about those two. There are some pretty horrific accusations about their work, their personal life, and the detrimental effects those have had on the lives of real people. Now, because of that, I'm sure our listeners are used to me not talking a lot when we talk about new movies, because I don't get out that often, right? But this is one of the few times where I actually am purposely not have seen these movies. I've only seen the first Conjuring, and
that was just last night.
Right, and it was just last night. Yeah. It was, because I gave it for the podcast. I was like, all right, I'll give it a shot. And you know what? I'm here to discuss the merits of that first film, but for all the sequels, I am going to be purposely quiet because of my beliefs with the Warren. That's a whole nother thing we might get into in a later episode. I don't know, but right now we're just here to discuss the movies. But I wanted to make that stance because I do know Lorraine passed recently, and there's a lot of stuff that's coming to light, a lot of stuff that's coming back into the light, and a lot of stuff. And I want to just at least make that point before moving on. Sorry for kind of disrupting and taking that break for you.
No,
guys.
These are valid points. They are, Ed and Lorraine Warren are very controversial figures, you know, in pop culture and I think in the parapsychology world. So, I don't think that you're alone in, you know, you might be alone in boycotting the movies because it is just entertainment. But, people boycott movies for stupider reasons. I mean,
But I mean, have you watched the first Conjuring recently? Like,
not in a couple years, but I have watched it a few times, and I love that first Conjuring. I think it's great.
It's really well made. Like, it is a phenomenal horror film. Like, I was on the edge of my seats for a lot of it. It really got under my nerves. But the mythification of the Warrens in that film is really, it's a lot.
Yeah.
It's a lot with, like, opening. Like, they really drive home, this is real. This is really real. This is based on real things, based on their things. And, like, there was a lot of stuff. Like, to end with that quote from Ed, what I felt very gross about.
Well, they went, The Conjuring 2, which, you know, if you haven't seen it, it's about the Enfield poltergeist, basically. Right. And that is hugely debunked. I mean,
the Snedkel family?
No. It's in Britain. I think Enfield is the name of the town. I'm not sure. Maybe that's the name of the people. But it's you've seen the picture of the girl she's supposedly levitating in the air, screaming. But it turns out that she jumped and they took the picture. I mean, it's a widely debunked case. But the thing is, they address that in the movie. At one point in the movie, one of the skeptics there goes to Ed and Lorraine and this other guy and goes, she's faking it. And she puts all this proof that the girl's faking it. And then, of course, they make a right turn and she wasn't faking it. But they do address, I thought that was interesting that in The Conjuring 2, they address the controversial case by, you know, they bring up in a skeptic to say she's faking it.
But then they completely ignore it and go, oh, but it's real.
Well, you know? It becomes more of a twist leading to another twist.
Yeah.
But, you know, right.
Yeah.
Although there's some great, well, that's the thing. You know, I don't really think of these movies too much on a narrative or especially not a historical accuracy basis. I think more about the scares. Like Conjuring 2 had some pretty good scares. Like, also, that's the one that introduces the nun, and there's a really good one too. With like they paint a picture of the nun, and then there's a part where Lorraine is locked inside a room with the portrait, and shit gets crazy.
The nun parts in The Conjuring 2 are scarier than anything in The Nun.
The Conjuring 2 is way better than The Nun.
Go on.
Like, I guess. Take this opportunity to segue into The Nun, which, I actually saw that in Screen X, so that was pretty fun, because it was very, very much a spectacle type of movie. And that's the thing, I really wanted to like The Nun, because it did have a pretty cool premise. It's like this haunted nunnery, in like Eastern Europe post-war, and it reminded me a lot of The Keep, you know, just kind of structurally, and also with the elements of like the ancient evil there. The problem though was there wasn't enough of the nun in the actual nun movie. Like you only see the nun like for a few scenes, and like the rest is just kind of random scares and stuff.
And there's no story to it. I mean, right now, I couldn't tell you what the story behind it was. It's parts of it are coming back from your description. And I do remember the ringing bells in the graveyard.
Yeah, that was
probably neat. The best scene in the movie.
I also liked those kind of ghost nuns, you know, like the nuns without faces that kind of drift by in certain scenes.
Yeah.
Like that was pretty cool too. But yeah, it kind of turned into like Demon Night toward the end, which was more off-putting than anything, because it was just such a tonal shift. And it's kind of like with the other stuff, they kind of tag on a Conjuring connection at the end.
Yeah.
So yeah, it could have been better.
And what about the Annabelle movies? What do you guys? I mean, the first one. I mean, we kind of discussed. It kind of suffers from its performances. I think the first one. Yeah. It's you don't care about those characters, so you don't really care much about the movie.
Right.
The second one. Did you see Annabelle Creation?
Yeah, I liked Annabelle Creation. Yeah. That was actually pretty well done.
Yeah, that one's pretty good, and it's got a cool. It's like, you know, an origin story of it kind of.
Yeah.
And I mean, those they assembled a great core ensemble of those little girls are just I mean, they're all just such great actresses.
Yeah. No, I felt like it. Was a very well constructed movie. Definitely an improvement. And it's what The Nun should have been like. And yeah, it had a nice cast, you know, like the group. Well, it had a good premise, like these orphan girls move into this family farmhouse with their caretaker, who is a nun, and the family lost their daughter, and they used to be toy or doll makers, and of course Annabelle's there. And yeah, that had some good scares too, like the creepy doll room. Like, I like that.
Yeah.
Oh, and also also it has one of my personal favorite subtropes, scary scarecrow. Like it wasn't really highlighted in the marketing or anything, but there is a recurring thing with this scarecrow on the farm, and it starts following these girls around. So that, like, I thought that was pretty scary.
It and we've talked about The Nun and La Llorona. So I mean, I guess Conjuring 3 and Annabelle Comes Home are both coming up, but I can tell you, and maybe this is what Conjuring 3 is going to be, the Ed and Lorraine Warren movie I want to see is, one, it is supposedly they were called on to exorcise a demon werewolf. I want a demon werewolf Conjuring movie. Korea's got something to say about that. Let's hear it.
This is where my strong feelings start coming out. No, the story
behind
that...
But don't you want to see that movie, though?
No, but here's the thing is that... And here's the thing is when it comes to... especially, like, a lot of their stories like that one, you're dealing with people who were dealing with, like, very real issues of mental health and addiction and alcoholism and all these stuff like that. So when it comes to the being possessed by a werewolf demon, which they have backtracked and said, oh, it wasn't the spirit of a werewolf. It was a demon who took the form of a werewolf while possessing this man. But it was a man who got violent by cops and tried getting off by saying he was possessed. And they were like, yeah, possessed by a werewolf, which is like, are you expecting us to believe werewolves are real now? What the fuck off.
Although I'm just with James on this, that it would make a good movie. Again, I'm not here for historical accuracy, and I know, you know, right, there's some very dubious stuff with that, but just as a horror fan, premise-wise, that does sound pretty awesome.
Yeah, that's the movie I want to see.
It does, but Conjuring 3 is supposed to be about the infamous case where they were, I forget the name of it and the names involved, but it's about this is what I last read, was that it's about this kid who was possessed by 47 demons, supposedly, and they assisted in an exorcism, and then the kid's sister's fiance, like 5 months later, ended up murdering his landlord, and in the real life case, the lawyer tried getting him off by not guilty, by demonic possession, not by, you know, huh, not, you know,
like
by,
Exorcism of Emily Rose.
Yeah, it wasn't a plea for insanity. It was a plea of demonic possession, which the Warrens did say, like, oh, yeah, no, this is definitely going to work because, you know, tell the truth.
Yeah.
And, oh, boy.
Yeah, that man is in life in prison and is not getting the medical help he needs.
Jesus
so
Christ.
That's part of my big reasons for my strong feelings with them.
Right.
All right.
And just, although talking more about the future, because I'm looking it up right now, apparently, let's see, there's a Crooked Man movie in development.
Oh, yes.
Conjuring 2, there was that thing, the Crooked Man, like the weird, creepy nursery rhyme character.
Which is Javier Botet, the that contortionist who's in, like, everything.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So that could be interesting, and I don't know, like, that it's kind of funny with all these movies, because, like, each one, you know, it's like, it's almost like every monster or ghost has the potential to get its own spinoff.
Yeah, well, I mean, as long as people come to see the movies,
yeah,
they're gonna keep making them, which is, you know, I guess as long as the movies are good, I'm cool with it.
Yeah, and which is why I also want to pitch my Annabelle Origins Scary Scarecrow movie. I want a movie about that scary scarecrow.
Well, I am not going to rest until we get Demon Werewolf, Conjuring 4, the Demon Werewolf, or whatever.
Yeah, and we're going to the 80s, baby.
That's going to be awesome. Let's move on to our actual topic, which we can kind of segue with talking about James Wan, but he was not the original. We're talking about horror directors who have kind of jumped, not really jumped ship, but have been tapped to make these big budget superhero movies. And I think that unless we're missing someone older, we think we were discussing it before we hit record, and we think Sam Raimi doing the Spider-Man movies. Oh, wait, Korea is shaking his head. He's got one older than that.
I know. See, we were discussing this before, and James was like, oh, wait, is it James Gunn? And we're like, no, there was Zack Snyder before him with Dawn of the Dead and all that.
Yeah.
No, it was Sam Raimi before that. But no, there's someone who did it before. There was someone who made the first.
Let's hear it.
The first big budget superhero movie. The one that kind of started the whole craze.
Don't even say Tim Burton, because he's not a horror guy.
Tim Burton, he's like a fringe, because he did make Jason. Beetlejuice before Batman. Mm. So you could maybe kind of count
but
him.
But don't keep us in
where
suspense.
Are you going with this,
what
John?
Do you got? Yeah.
Fucking Richard Donner, man. He made The Omen.
Oh, you are
and
right.
And then did
You're
Superman.
Right.
You were right.
Oh, damn.
Damn.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Oh, my God. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah. Dude, this has been a trend. And that was what's interesting, because you see
that
it a lot
the
more these days, especially with the DC Extended Universe and the Marvel Universe and all that. But no, this goes all the way back to Superman the Motion Picture, back in 1978.
But see, I don't think Richard Donner was actually a horror director. He just happened to make a horror movie.
I think it counts.
Well, I mean, he mostly did TV.
And he did Tales
that.
From the Crypt. He did Richard Donner helped produce Tales from the Crypt.
Yeah, and that's before, true. He's a horror guy.
Yeah.
And before all that, when he was working in TV, he did a bunch of episodes of The Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
okay.
He's definitely...
I stand corrected. He's a horror guy.
Yeah, which...
We'll claim him.
Which, you know, I feel like is something that's going to come up a lot. Like, you know, people who did a lot of horror and do superhero movies and stuff after that, like, they like genre. They like fantasy. They, you know, and I feel like there's a lot of cross-section there.
So what makes these guys, because it's not just that they're doing it well. Like we said, Zack Snyder went from Dawn of the Dead to The Watchmen. And I mean, right now you've got two of the biggest superhero movies of the year, Aquaman and Shazam, were done by James Wan and David F. Sandberg, who I wasn't a huge fan of Lights Out, but you have to admit it is a well-made movie. And yep. Then that dude jumped it to Shazam.
Which was awesome.
Yeah, I loved Shazam.
Shazam was great.
So what makes a studio look at a movie like Slither and then tap James Gunn to say, you know what, we're going to have you make this Marvel movie?
Preface on... James Gunn. Well, I feel like it wasn't so much Slither, but remember he did Slither, then he did Super with Rainn Wilson, which was kind of a superhero parody.
Yeah.
So I feel like it's probably a combination of the two is what helped him cement his place in Guardians of the Galaxy, because in some ways it's elements of both those movies.
So you don't think that it was his trauma work that
Romeo and Juliet made him a cinch. Guardians of the Galaxy, Romeo and Juliet.
Well, I mean, you know, the giant mutant penis scene in Romeo and Juliet definitely scored him that multi-million dollar Marvel gig, you know? And Suicide Squad, let's not forget that.
Oh, yeah.
But also, another huge superhero movie to come out later this year, Spider-Man Far From Home, which John Watts is directing again. He did Spider-Man Homecoming, and he did the phenomenal Cop Car, which was a good, like... horror thriller if made by like Amblin back in the 80s, but he also did Clown, which was a lot of fun as well. So I mean, you can kind of see the connections between him, especially from Cop Car to Spider-Man, because he did such a phenomenal job with those kids in that movie. Like, those were some of the best child performers that I've seen in recent time. Like, I can't praise Cop Car enough. That was just such a fun movie.
You know, was Sucker Punch after Dawn of the Dead or before? I'm wondering so was that the natural link between Dawn of the Dead and The Watchmen, or was Sucker Punch after The Watchmen too?
Sucker Punch was after, that was before Man of Steel, because it was like the whole like,
okay,
all the Zack Snyder bros were like, oh yeah, Zack Snyder's doing something original, and then he literally did every video game ever thrown into one movie.
And put in a blender.
The first decade of the 2000s is just a huge blur to
me. Man, it was weird stuff like that. That basically was par for course. Although we also mustn't forget that James Gunn wrote the script for the Dawn of the Dead remake. So I feel like, you know, he does have a good kind of roadmap that kind of led him to doing superhero movies.
But even so, there's directors like Scott
Derrickson.
Derrickson.
Dirksen. Sorry. My apologies, Scott. He did Sinister. Prior to doing Doctor Strange.
Yeah, right. Figured that one out.
He also did Exorcism of Emily Rose, which we talked about earlier.
Yeah, and I feel like that actually was perfect for him, because Doctor Strange is a superhero movie, but it's also a fantasy, especially a very dark fantasy type of character and story, because... like Sinister has Bagul, like evil spirits and gods, and Doctor Strange fights evil spirits and gods, and evil wizard Mads Mikkelsen.
So how did Sam Raimi end up with Spider-Man?
Darkman, of course.
Through Darkman?
Darkman, dude.
Yeah, again, like, this is like, we are basically doing a pedigree on these filmmakers' careers, and it does kind of sync up, because there's a whole story I want to get into on that, because, you know, he did Army of Darkness, and then he wanted to do the Shadow movie. You know, they were doing a movie adaptation of the old pulp comic book character The Shadow, but Sam Raimi didn't get it, so he was like, okay, well, I'll just make up my own superhero. So he creates a superhero for Detroit, and it's Liam Neeson, who's this geneticist who gets beaten up and left for dead by these gangsters, with the lead one played by the great late Larry Drake. And so he's left deformed, and it also, like, I think he's got, like, super strength, but he uses, like, this formula he made to create fake faces to disguise himself so that he can get revenge. So he's, and also, like, he's kind of a, and he is a very pulpy superhero because he is not afraid to kill people.
Well, he also can't feel pain,
right?
Isn't it?
Yeah, like, yeah, he loses pain because he got burns all
accident.
Over his body.
Yeah.
And so that's the thing. If you watch Darkman and watch it back-to-back with Spider-Man, there are so many parallels because, like, the whole thing with Darkman and Willem Dafoe as the Green Goblin, like, there's a lot of stuff that kind of syncs up between their origins.
Well, not only that, but also you look at Spider-Man 2, like that whole scene where Doc Ock first, where the accident happens and you see through the eyes of like the octopus arms and robot arms and whatnot. Yeah. Those are Evil Dead shots. Those are the shots of the spirits going through the
woods.
There's
even a scene where like some doctors are trying to surgically remove the arms off them. They come to life and kill them. And like one of the doctors takes a surgical chainsaw and tries to fight them off.
You can definitely tell those Spider-Man movies are directed by Sam Raimi. There's no secret behind that.
The Spider-Man movies are screwball comedies, you know, because one of the biggest underlining stories of all three movies is Peter Parker and Mary Jane's romance and like the kind of love triangle they have with Harry Osborn. And it has a very screwball comedy vibe to it because it's like Peter keeps on screwing up and like there's all these issues and then, you know, compounded with like his superhero identity. But there's always comedy. It always bits with him, especially, you know, just trying to live day by day, like, because he's a pizza delivery guy for a while. But anyway, yeah, so in some ways, yeah, it has like an old school screwball comedy vibe to it.
Like Army of Darkness.
Do you guys consider Wes Craven's Swamp Thing to be a superhero movie, or like, I guess a comic book movie? It's a comic book movie.
Yeah,
definitely.
He's a superhero and a comic book.
There's and that one worked because it was kind of a darker, it's almost a monster movie, basically. It's basically King Kong, you know, kind of.
Frankenstein.
Yeah, yeah. So because he's a DC comic book character, yeah, so there you go. Craven has... When do we get John Carpenter's superhero movie?
We did. It's called Escape from New York.
Okay. What about David Cronenberg? Where's his superhero movie?
The Fly.
Yeah, The Fly. Come on. No, but that's the thing is that, especially when you look at Swamp Thing and you read the comics and you know the history behind the character is, he, especially later on when he joins up with like other characters from the DC universe, he is... does take on a superhero like role, but he was never really a superhero. He was more just like a tragic monster character, which I would argue is kind of the core of most superheroes. They all have that like kind of transformative background story, whether it's, you know, dead parents or a lab accident or something of that nature.
Villains too. Most super villains have the same like sympathetic background story. It's just a matter of, you know, did the switch click to good or evil when it happened?
God, yeah. Like again, the Sam Raimi movies, like, the villains' origins, I feel a lot of time paralleled, like, you know, like what happened to Darkman. It's just like the circumstances are different. Like, seriously, you watch Darkman's origin, you compare it to like how they handled the origins of Dr. Octopus or Green Goblin in those movies. It's a lot of similar beats, but just they went evil, Darkman went good.
And that's, I think, what the main connection between all of them is. When it comes to horror, you have to have a good villain with a horror film. Because, I mean, that you can't have something horror be horrible without something evil. And good is always fighting evil. And that's the core of superhero movies, too. So I think that's why a lot of times horror directors are tapped to make these. Because without a good villain, like, come on. I think Star Wars has proven that you can have... As long as you have a really good villain, your main character can be very bland and whiny. Sorry, Luke, but you were kind of whiny throughout most of the series.
But evil will always triumph over good because good is dumb.
Good is always... Why is that? Why is always the good character has to be pretty fucking dumb? Like, do you notice that's a big, like, trope? Anyways. Well,
because it puts them at a disadvantage to the... You know, it puts Austin Powers at a disadvantage to Dr. Evil.
It creates room for character growth because they have to get not dumb They have to be they have to be not as dumb.
But some more horror directors who went on to make comic book movies. Let's not forget Guillermo del Toro, who did Kronos, Mimic, Devil's Backbone before doing Blade 2 and following that quickly up with Hellboy, or the first Hellboy.
Yep.
Who else? Taika Waititi?
Yeah.
Made What We Do in the Shadows before Thor Ragnarok. Yep.
Do you count What We Do in the Shadows as a horror movie now?
I mean, it's horror comedy. It kind of has some horror. Well, I mean, it's vampires and it has some horror elements to it. But
werewolves.
Not swear wolves.
Yeah. Although the thing I love about that, though, is that he did like that extra material, like, I forget what it was, but it's basically like he did the bit with like Thor being roommates with some random dude in Australia, and then that same dude moves to America and he needs a new roommate, and he ends up roommates with Jeff Goldblum's character, the Grandmaster, and it's basically like What We Do in the Shadows if it was aliens instead. So I think he just kind of gets that, you know, despite how fantastical and amazing some of these characters are, he can still be down to earth with them. And he has a lot of funny bits with like Thor and Loki and Valkyrie. And like he did a great job with Cate Blanchett as Hela, the goddess of death. And like she was pretty serious too. And like she had kind of horror powers because like she resurrects an army of the dead.
Which is true. Again, you need a really good villain.
Yeah.
And who better to do villains than people who have done horror and done horror well? Because a lot of these directors, when we talk about their earlier films, they're not big budget horror films for the most part. These are all smaller ones. Scott Derrickson did Hellraiser Inferno, which went straight to video, you know? Evil Dead was super low budget as well. They showed that they could craft something very well with almost no money as well. So you can imagine, it's almost like, hey, here's a bigger sandbox to play in, you know?
Yeah, like, I guess it's more of a proving ground, you know, like they were able to show they could do a little with a lot, and especially it showed that they had a very vast imagination, which is the key to both horror and superhero movies. You need a big imagination for these big stories.
Kind of like Joss Whedon, huh?
Yeah.
Who did Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Yeah, there you go.
And then went on to do the first Avengers.
Yeah.
As a second movie, because he only did Serenity, which was his only feature prior to that.
Pretty much.
Which had a lot of horror elements in that, too.
Yeah, the Reavers. Yeah. So, there's definitely a lot of crossover there.
Oh, yeah. Now, I have one, and I think this is going to kind of go under fringe a little bit, but what about James Mangold?
What did he
do? Who did The Wolverine and Logan. He also did Identity before that.
Huh.
Identity is pretty much of a stretch for a... Because then you could say that... Chris Nolan did Memento before The Dark Knight, you know?
Yeah, but
it's about the same thing.
I mean, I feel like Identity counts as horror. Like, it did have those elements.
I think Memento kind of counts as horror.
Yeah.
I mean, that's my nightmare.
That's the thing, though, that it actually really syncs up, because the whole thing with Wolverine, I don't remember those movies, have been a while, but, like, you know, he loses his identity, so, like, a lot of his core character is about him figuring out who he was. So it kind of makes sense, you know, having a director like that.
Now, who are some independent horror filmmakers that you think maybe you guys might have a comic book character in mind, maybe not, but who do you think should be next to kind of rise up to that challenge?
I want Panos Cosmatos to team up with Nick Cage again to do a Ghost Rider movie. Because, I mean, that's... Because, again, bringing it back to Mandy, like, he... I mean, there's a whole part... Like, a whole section of the movie is him fighting these demon bikers. So, you know, like, I feel like, you know, Panos Cosmatos, of all people, could handle, you know, like, doing one fucking crazy and ethereal Ghost Rider movie, especially if they got Nicolas Cage back.
See, this is what I love about doing this podcast, because we kind of discussed how we were going to kind of move past Rampage this season. But we didn't mention moving past Mandy.
I will never move past Mandy.
I know. We can't stop you. We can't. But I mean, you made a really good point. I would watch that. I feel like, though, I would be just as excited as I was for Spirit of Vengeance, because that was going to be directed by the directors who did the Crank series, and they showed Ghost Rider pissing fire. So I was stoked for that movie. And yeah, that was boring.
This is going to be kind of low hanging fruit, but I would like to see a Jordan Peele Power Man movie, Luke Cage Power Man.
Oh, yeah.
And here we're going to bring it back to Rampage. I want Dwayne Johnson to play Power Man.
But he's already tapped to play Black Adam, yeah. But he can do both.
Well, yeah. I don't know.
Oh, that reminds me. We didn't even really talk about Shazam. Like I thought that was a great adaptation, and also like that's a big too. Like a lot, there were some complaints because kids were scared watching it because you know it had all the demons and stuff, which was great.
Yeah,
because that's a thing.
The deadly sins.
Yeah, yeah, and again, I think that's a great thing because you know like having a horror director do a PG a hard PG-13 movie like that and superhero movie with like a lot of kid appeal. Yeah, like, you know, it amps up the intensity.
Yeah. I mainly love Shazam for that massive OC reference. Like that, I jumped up and cheered in the theaters when that came up. But that's just me.
And yeah, also Mark Strong as the bad guy, Savannah, I thought he did a great job.
Yeah. Personally, I'd like to see the Soska sisters do a superhero movie.
Funny you mentioned that because they're currently writing the Black Widow series for Marvel.
Yeah, and they've written for Deadpool as well. So they know comics really well. They can do action. They've proven that with what was that one movie with Dean Cain where it was like a prison movie or revenge? It was
American Mary.
It was no, it wasn't American Mary, but it was one of their WWE produced movies. It was what they did after See No Evil 2.
Shoot,
fuck, can't remember. But I don't know who I would want that. I would want them to do like a Dark Horse character or a lesser known one. I don't know if I would want them to do like Black Widow or Deadpool.
Oh, Vendetta. It was called Vendetta.
Vendetta. My bad. Sorry, Soskis. I had fun with Vendetta. It was cool seeing Dean Cain go there. But I would like to see them take on like a lesser known character and kind of make it their own and bring it up, you know?
Mm.
Well, all right. We got anything else to say about horror superheroes?
I mean, if you want to bring up John Liebsman, who did Darkness Falls and Texas Chainsaw Massacre the beginning and then went to go on make Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, we could bring that up.
Sure. Hey.
There you go.
That's all I have to say about that one.
That's all there is.
Not to bash his career, but I had fun with the live action recent Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle movies.
Let's get out of here then. Let's call this an episode.
All right.
Our music is still Restless Spirit, because I have no desire to change it. I think our music rocks. And our artwork is still Chris Fisher, because it rules too. I mean, what? I told you guys you wouldn't even notice that we are coming back for a second season. It's a second season in name only. In fact, I still consider this our 23rd episode. Mm-hmm. So you can find me, James J. Edwards, on Twitter at Cinema Ferite. That's F-E-A-R-I-T-E, like verite, but fear. Where can we find you guys on Twitter, Jacob?
You can find me at J-A-C-O-B-D-A-V-I-S-O-N _. That is at Jacob Davison _.
And Korea?
And you can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Korean Barbecue. That's C-O-R-R-E-I-A-N-B-B-Q. And don't forget to follow iHorror on Twitter, check out the website, and us on Stardust.
And while you're on Facebook, you like that segue? Go to the Eye on Horror Facebook page and say hello to us there. Give us a follow. And, you know, every once in a while we give something away. So keep your ear to the ground on that. And we should make it our season 2 resolution to be a little more active over there, because sometimes life gets in the way and we forget to promote our podcast.
Yeah, but sometimes we post random things. Like we asked you, our fans, which did you prefer, Blackenstein versus Frankenhooker? Because that was just on my mind that day. And I think Frankenhooker won like...
Oh, yeah. Big time.
99% of the votes. Like, I think Blackenstein got one vote.
And that's, you know, that's not really fair, because you can... It's kind of like, you know, you can like the Beatles or you can like Elvis... but nobody likes them both equally. That's kind of what it was. That was a Sophie's choice for me, because I love them both, but Frankenhooker took it for me.
Hennenlotter, man. Hennenlotter.
Yeah.
Well, at least Frankenhooker, the filmmakers knew how to light a scene. You know, Blackenstein, you could barely see anything most of the time.
Well, that's it. That's for another episode. Yeah. Anyway, give us a follow over there on Facebook. And while you're on Facebook, give iHorror a follow. And I don't know. Do whatever the hell you want over there on Facebook.
It's your life to live.
You do you. Yeah. So we're going to get out of here. We will see you next time. For me, I'm James J. Edwards.
I'm Jacob Davison.
And I'm Jonathan Correa.
Keep your eye on horror.